continue our study of the chiral anomaly. Today we'll do things a bit more carefully. I made a number of what I claimed were unnecessary assumptions yesterday. We're going to work in 4D today instead of 2D, but the basic idea behind the derivation would work very similarly in two dimensions. So our plan today is we'll spend most of the lecture deriving the chiral anomaly that we studied, began to study yesterday, using functional integrals. At the end, I'll say a few words about deriving the chiral anomaly from Feynman diagrams and perturbation theory. So we'll get different perspectives on where and why the chiral anomaly arises from these two very different perspectives. But most of the work in deriving the chiral anomaly from Feynman diagrams and perturbation theory you'll do in tutorial this afternoon. That's where we're going over the rest of today's lecture. And for simplicity, we're going to work until the very end, at least, in Euclidean space. And the theory we'll study is massless QED in four dimensions. So, well, we only have, classically have a chiral symmetry if our fermions are massless. So the fact that we're dealing with massless QED is or massless fermions is essential. The fact that our gauge symmetry is a U1 abelian gauge symmetry is not very essential, but that's a case I'll treat. Just for simplicity, I'll make a few comments about what would change if we were looking at the chiral symmetry in a non-abelian gauge theory. It's not very much of a change. I'll comment briefly on that at the end. Some details will change depending on the dimension, but the basic idea behind the derivation works fairly similarly in even dimensions. And the fact that we're working in Euclidean space will be a huge simplification. And the reason for that is that in Euclidean space, ID slash or Dirac operator, or covariant Dirac operator is Hermitian. And that's going to play a key role in the derivation. So some parts of this are essential, other parts are not so much. Okay, so just a brief reminder about what changes when we go to Euclidean space. So we know that the gamma matrices satisfy this anti-commutation relation. And so if we're working in Euclidean space, it tells us that the anti-commutator should be 2 delta mu nu. And I'm done with this equation. Some people like to take a well-seasoned steak and add ketchup to it. At least one person thinks it's a good idea to add a scene where Greedo shoots first to A New Hope. A number of authors think that the Euclidean metric needs a minus sign. Well, everyone has their own taste, but I'm done with that equation. So in Euclidean space, unlike in Minkowski space, all of the gamma matrices can be Hermitian. So to see that, we can write out what they are in the chiral basis. So gamma 1, 2, and 3, we can choose to be 0 and I times the Pauli matrices. minus I times all matrices, and gamma 4. We can just choose to be have the 2x2 identity matrices in the off-diagonal terms. These matrices are clearly all Hermitian. Which will be essential for what we're about to do. And of course, the most important of the gamma matrices for what we're going to do is gamma 5, which in Euclidean space we define without an I. So no I. And this is also Hermitian. Okay, so what we're going to, our object of study, is going to be the following path integral. It's going to be, I'm going to integrate over fermion field, this conjugate of e to minus the action of, action is the action for massless QED. And notice we're not doing the integral over the gauge field. So here we're integrating only over the fermion field, and we're defining some functional of the gauge fields. As we saw yesterday, in two dimensions, but it's also true in four dimensions, massless QED, the action is invariant under a global chiral transformation. Today, it'll be convenient to consider a local chiral transformation. So here, we'll consider a local chiral transformation. So just what you'd expect, the fermion fields transform just like they did yesterday, except for the parameter theta is now a function of space-time, and conjugate fields transform in the same way. The action is not invariant under its local transformation. It picks up an extra term that depends on the derivative of theta. If we integrate by parts, we can move that derivative onto the other part, which will leave us just with this new term. So our new term is just this parameter, which is now a function of space-time, times the divergence of the axial current. So that's just taking these transformations, plug it in. When the derivative acts on theta, we get an extra term. Integrate by parts, we get and write it like that. So z of a is a functional only of the gauge field. And let me add this here. Of course, our gauge field is invariant under this transformation. So z of a should be independent of theta. So that tells us that 0 should be equal to the functional derivative of z of a with respect to theta, evaluated at theta equals 0. And, well, we've just figured out how the action changes when we do a local chiral transformation. So that tells us that just plug in a result, the integral d psi, psi bar of e to the minus s minus integral of theta is the divergence of the axial current at theta equals 0. And we can now evaluate the functional derivative only a theta dependence here. And we get this, evaluate the functional derivative, which is nothing other than the vacuum expectation value of the divergence of the axial current. There's only one operator. We can just pull out the derivative. And this seems to say that the axial current is conserved. So obviously, we made a mistake here. Because we saw yesterday, axial current's not conserved. Anyone see what mistake we made? Call from yesterday, I briefly mentioned it. We didn't transform the measure. So that's exactly the problem. So I calculated how the action transforms, but I just assumed that after we did this local chiral transformation, measure was invariant. That's not true. And let's show that now. So this doesn't work. It actually took people decades to realize the problem in its derivation. It was first realized by Fujikawa in 1979. The anomaly was known well before that. So measure is not invariant. So in order to derive an anomaly, we're going to do two things. First, we're going to figure out how the measure transforms. And that's going to give us a new term in this equation. We'll have a new term. And then in order to evaluate the anomaly, we're going to have to evaluate that new term. And that will give us, we'll have this term plus something else is equal to 0. So it is true that this functional integral is independent of theta. So this first step is fine, but there should be an additional term here, which will tell us what the actual divergence of the axial current is equal to. So that's where we're going. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
It's usually what we do with a mute, we say that it picks up some kind of term to keep s invariant. So why are we now saying s is changing but a is invariant?
We're not doing a gauge transformation here. We're just asking what would happen if we do a local chiral transformation. We know chiral symmetry is not a local symmetry. It's only a global symmetry. Mm-hmm. So we only expect that this is a symmetry in the limit where theta is constant. Nevertheless, pretending it's a local symmetry is a useful technique. So here we're setting theta equal to zero. That's a constant in space-time. Because z is a functional only of a, and a does not transform under chiral transformations.
Yeah, when you introduce theta now, it's also a functional of theta.
So here, when we're setting theta equal to zero, we're going back to the global case, where it is a symmetry, or the classical symmetry at least.
Yeah. If you didn't do that, is this an identity that should follow from the future definition invariance of the side function to give you the same result?
Yes, we could also.
Presumably, that's the reason. Functional integral just integrating over size, and that they're just labels. You can just change the label, and the theta is just an artifact of that.
That's right. That's another way to think about this. So, next answer. Okay. So. What we want to do is, so first we'll define the measure and then see how it transforms when we do this transformation. And to do that, it will be useful to introduce a complete set of eigenfunctions. And so here we'll use the fact that id slash is Hermitian. You see that, note that we have several terms here, so this is I ordinary derivative slashed minus a slash. So our gamma matrices are all Hermitian, and I times derivative, that's like the momentum operator, it's the zeroth component, so that's Hermitian. A are real fields, so we conjugate this. This is Hermitian. So id slash has a complete set of eigenfunctions with real eigenvalues. And we can choose an orthonormal basis where the integral I n dagger I m is just delta n m. And it's complete, so we have this identity that the sum over n of phi n dagger of x phi n beta y is delta x minus y delta alpha beta. So here alpha and beta are the Dirac indices. And so we can expand our fermion fields in terms of these eigenfunctions. And our conjugate fields we can expand in terms of conjugated coefficients, eigenfunctions. We're here, an and bn are Grassmann variables. And we can define our measure then. And the measure is just the product over me and db bar n. So we want to figure out how this transforms after we do a chiral transformation. And so after a chiral transformation, we can expand again our fermion fields in the same basis. The coefficients will change. And we can compute these coefficients as follows. So an prime phi n inner product of phi n with psi prime, which we know is write this over here. I need a bit more space. A n prime inner product of phi n with the transformed field. It's just phi n e to the I theta gamma phi times the original field, which we can write as we expand, write phi in terms of its eigenfunction expansion. We just get a sum over am times phi n e to the I theta 5 phi m. And so this is just some matrix, which we can call CNM. And similarly for BN bar. So the first half of the measure after this chiral transformation just picks up a inverse Jacobian because these are Grassmann variables. Which we can write in a more useful form as the exponential of minus the trace of the log of c which this is C. C is just the matrix elements, or here this expression is just the matrix elements of C, which are the matrix elements of e to the I theta gamma 5. Take the log of that, and we're just left with the exponential of minus I times the trace of theta gamma 5. And so here, this trace, I'll use capital trace to indicate both a matrix and a functional trace. So the trace here, what's meant by this notation, is this is the, so by functional trace, I mean we're integrating over this sandwich between the eigenfunctions. I've got a theta. And we also have the matrix trace. We're tracing over the Dirac indices of gamma 5. So this is the new term that we left out at the beginning of the lecture. So we can go back and correct this equation. So to correct this equation, we need to include here minus 2i, so we'll get the 2 comes to the fact we'll get this trace from transforming the a's. We'll get the same trace from transforming the b's. So we get 2i times this trace of theta gamma 5. And then we'll get a new term here and here. So this is what we need to calculate in order to figure out what the anomaly is. So let's try to do that. What I want to calculate is trace of theta gamma 5, which is the integral of pi n alpha theta gamma 5 pi n beta x. And we can use this completeness relation to get, well, we just replace this sum with a delta of x minus x. We still have the theta. And we also have a delta alpha beta, which just gives us then a trace gamma 5. So got here a delta of 0, which gives us infinity, and a trace of gamma 5, which gives us 0. So obviously ill-defined, and we're going to have to work a little bit harder to make sense of this. It shouldn't be so much of a surprise that we get something like this, because after all, as we did several times in QFT, one, we can interpret this delta of 0 just as an integral over momentum of e to the I e dot x, or x minus y, evaluated at x equals y. So this is a UV divergence. And as I mentioned at the end of yesterday's lecture, UV divergences are critical for anomalies. We can think of anomalies as arising when we can't find a UV regulator that respects its symmetries. If we don't need a UV regulator, then it's not going to be a problem. So in order to compute this, we need a UV regulator. And a convenient choice is to insert a function I'll call f into the integral. And we'll choose the property so that it will cut off the problematic UV behavior of this integral. So the assumptions we'll make about f are we'll assume that f 0 is 1, and that f and all its derivatives vanish at infinity. Precise form won't matter, but if you would like to have a concrete example in mind, you can think of something like k squared could be e to the minus k squared, or 1 over 1 plus k squared. So the purpose of inserting this function is going to be to smooth or throw away some of the problematic UV behavior in this integral. So any questions at this point? So let's insert this function into the integral. So our regulated trace will take the form limit as lambda goes to infinity. Still have this integral. And we'll throw in this function. And the argument will be minus lambda n squared over lambda. And so inserting this function will reduce the effects of the very the eigenfunctions with large eigenvalues and improve the UV behavior of this integral. And in the end, we'll take our cutoff lambda to infinity. So we can, this lambda are the eigenvalues of our Hermitian differential operator, ID slash. We can, in this equation, replace lambda n with ID slash. And so the rest of the computation will be easier if we Fourier transform these variables. So we can do that. We do a Fourier transform. Write this as the limit lambda goes to infinity, integral x, k and k prime. And then we've got here the Fourier transform of by dagger. It's now a function of k prime. And similarly for phi, be a function of k. OK, so the next thing we want to do is move this exponential past f. F contains derivatives. So if we move, if we want to move this past, we can use the identity that d slash of acting e to the I k x, same as e to the I, say times a function, is the same as e to the I k x, I k slash plus d slash times that function, and that function. So using this identity, we can reverse this order. And I won't rewrite the whole thing, but this part then becomes e to the I kx f of minus id slash minus k slash over lambda squared I tilde. So in this form, we're still summing over these eigenfunctions. We have this completeness relation in position space. And there's a corresponding version of this in momentum space. So in momentum space, this equation is entirely equivalent to the equation that the Fourier transforms are equal to 2 pi to the fourth, L to the 4, k minus k prime. Here, this is the spinner identity. And these two are equivalent. So we'll use this version of the completeness relation now. And expression will start to get smaller. Okay, so if we use that completeness relation, then we can here we'll get a delta for k's, and we can do one of the k integrals. And if we do that, then what we're left with is the trace eta gamma 5 limit goes to infinity. Integral, still have one k integral. And this small trace is just the matrix trace. And all we have left then is we're getting close. What we want to do next is Taylor expand F. So, well, the reason we want to do that is, well, we expect if we do a Taylor expansion, the terms with more powers of 1 over lambda squared, the denominator will be less important and will vanish compared to the first non-trivial term. Not non-zero term as we take lambda to infinity. So if we Taylor expand this, what we get, we can write this term as sum n equals from n equals 0 to infinity 1 over n factorial minus I slash lambda to the 2n. It's the nth derivative of f of k squared over lambda squared. So we're expanding around k squared over lambda squared. And so as lambda goes to infinity, the higher order terms should be negligible. So all we really care about is the first non-zero term. And, well, you can figure out what the first non-zero term is by considering the trace. So if n equals 0, what we're considering then, if we look at this trace, we just have the trace of gamma 5, which is 0. So n equals 0 doesn't contribute. If we go to n equals 1, we have two gamma matrices here. And then we've got the trace of gamma 5, gamma mu, gamma nu, which again is 0. So the first non-zero term is n equals 2, which has the trace of gamma 5 with 4 gamma mu's. And so then, so that's the only term we need to consider. So n equals 2 term will be much greater than the n equals and greater than or equal to 3 terms as lambda goes to infinity. So we can take the lambda goes to infinity limit now, and this trace will just be equal to the n equals 2 term. And so we can compute the n equals 2 term using trace. So in Euclidean space, this trace is slightly modified from what you're used to. There's no I. Otherwise, it's just this familiar identity, QFT1. And so what we're left with then is this trace. It's equal to this integral. And we still have this f double prime, k squared, lambda squared. And well, we can evaluate this k integral by doing change of variables. So got d4k over lambda to the fourth prime. K squared over lambda squared. Make the change of variables q equals k squared over lambda squared. This becomes the integral 0 to infinity, q dq, f double prime, q times an angular integral. It's an angular integral you've evaluated, qft2. This gives you pi squared. And we can evaluate the q integral by integrating by parts. So if we do that, our boundary term is q f prime of q, evaluated at 0 and infinity. And then we're left with integral of f prime. So this boundary term vanishes by, well, q equals 0. We've got a factor of q here, so this vanishes. And by assumption, f and all its derivatives vanish at infinity. So at both boundaries, the boundary term vanishes. We're just left with this term, which we can integrate directly. And we get pi squared times minus f q evaluated at 0 and infinity. And again, the f and all its derivatives vanish at infinity, so we're just left with f at 0, which is 1 by assumption. These integrals just give us a pi squared. And show that this 4 epsilon times 4 d's is equal to epsilon nu rho sigma times f mu nu f rho sigma. And we just plug in those two results. So this is just a few lines of algebra. I'm going to go through now. I've done enough already today, and we're just about done. We just plug in this result. And this result, we're done. And we have computed the anomaly. And our final expression for this trace is it's the integral theta over 32 pi squared epsilon mu nu rho sigma f mu nu f rho sigma. That's our final result. And so if we go back to our equation from the beginning of the board, from the beginning of lecture, we now have an additional term here. There's a factor of 2 and a factor of I we also need to account for. But what we'll get is additional terms here and here, and I'll just write it final version. So here we'll get a plus, minus 1 over, let me write it as a new equation. So this calculation was in Euclidean space. We can now Wick rotate back Minkowski space. And with the Wick rotation, we'll get an additional factor of I that will cancel that I. And what we'll be left with is in Minkowski space, the divergence of the axial current is equal to 1 over 16 pi squared epsilon u nu rho sigma f mu nu f rho sigma. Which looks very similar to what we derived yesterday in, or motivated in, made an inspired guess in the last step yesterday, but very similar to the final equation we had yesterday for the chiral anomaly in 2 dimensions. We're in 4 dimensions, so our epsilon has to have 4 indices instead of 2. Coefficient's different, but if we repeated this derivation in 2 dimensions, we could derive the equation from yesterday. So this is our equation for the chiral anomaly. And just a brief comment about what's on the right-hand side. So here, we're doing everything quantum mechanically, but we're only doing functional integrals over the fermion fields. So you might wonder what's the chiral anomaly going to look like when we do full quantum theory and integrate over all our fields. So in that case, we'll be integrating over some gauge field configurations where this right-hand side is not zero. And in fact, this right-hand side is related to it's what's known as the instanton density. So the and instantons are what we'll talk about next week. So we'll see this expression again next week. And what are instantons? Instantons are non-trivial saddle points of the functional integrals. So in a sense, the dominant contributions to the chiral anomaly will come from these non-trivial saddles. And we'll discuss, I guess, this a bit more next week. So any questions on this path integral derivation? But what we saw was that we traced the anomaly back to the non-invariance of the measure. And then that gave us a new term, which we could evaluate once we introduced a UV regulator. So In tutorial today, we're going to derive this anomaly from a completely different perspective. In the last few minutes, I just want to say a few words about where the chiral anomaly comes from if we're thinking about Feynman diagrams and perturbation theory. So in perturbation theory, the anomaly comes from triangle diagrams. And why is that? So I'll add to these diagrams in a minute, but they come from diagrams which contain loops of fermions. I'll just draw this diagram. So from diagrams like this, that contain one-loop diagrams with three internal fermion propagators. So just a brief word, motivation about why these diagrams are the ones that contribute to the anomaly. We need a gamma 5 in the diagram in order to get an anomaly. So, and why is that? So we've seen that anomalies arise when we can't find a UV regulator that respects the symmetries. There's no gamma 5 there. Dimensional regularization respects most symmetries, and that will work. The problem with using dimensional regularization when we have a gamma 5 is that gamma 5 is only well-defined in four dimensions, so that doesn't really make sense. There can be ambiguities if we try to use dimensional regularization or diagrams that contain gamma 5s. So that means we want we need fermions running in the loop. And so a diagram like this is going to contain a gamma 5 and 4 gamma matrices, so the trace will not be 0. We need at least 4 other gamma matrices, which means we need at least 3 fermions running a loop in order to get something on 0. So we need 3 or more fermions to get enough gamma matrices. If we had more fermions than the diagram, will become more and more convergent. We have more propagators that will reduce the divergence. If we had too many fermion loops, if we had more than 3, then the diagrams will be finite. We won't need, we won't have these problems with UV regulators. So schematically, that's why we might expect that this can be made. The arguments can be more precise, but just in a couple of minutes, that's why these diagrams with one-loop diagrams of 3 internal fermions are the ones that contribute to the chiral anomaly. And so what you're going to compute in tutorial this afternoon will be correlations of currents. In particular, what you'll compute is this correlator with one axial current and 2 vector currents. And if all of these currents are conserved in the quantum theory, we'd expect that if we acted with, for example, E x alpha, that should be 0. And similarly, if we acted with the derivative with respect to d y mu or d z nu. So that's what it would mean for these currents to be conserved in the quantum theory. And what you'll show in the tutorial is that it's impossible to find a regulator which lets all of these divergences go to zero at the same time. And the way you're going to do that is basically by computing the momentum space version of these correlators. And in momentum space, and define this object which I'll call M5, which depends on three momenta. We have a P, Q1, and Q2. And I'll assume add up to zero. Which will be defined to be this Fourier transform of this position space correlator of the currents. And so if I write this out in terms of the fermion fields, this expression should almost look familiar. Well, it almost looked like the type of object that we studied in QFT1. So if we just look at replace this correlator of the currents with how the currents are defined in terms of the fermion fields, this looks almost like how we define the S matrix in terms of by the LSE formula. So the difference between what we've got here and what we had before is there's no LSE projection operators. And several of these fields are evaluated at the same point. But otherwise, it's basically the same thing. And so we can compute it more or less like how we would compute a matrix element, just with the realization that we don't have any external particles, only the internal ones. So in fact, we can compute M5 by computing these two diagrams. So let me explain a little bit more. So using the usual Feynman rules, if we're computing these diagrams, we not only have to worry about the internal fermion loop, but we'd also have to worry about the external particles. So momentum here is Q1, Q2. Our formula over here has no external particles, so we should just disregard any of the external particles. Our gauge boson couples directly to the vector current. So that's why I've drawn a gauge boson at two of the vertices. The vertices with momentum Q1 and Q2 flowing in. And we could add to our theory, just for the purpose of calculating these diagrams, some new particle that couples to the axial current. In our theory, we don't have touch of particle, but we could touch a field. We could add a field. And really, it's just for the purpose of drawing these diagrams. When we compute the diagrams, we throw away the external particles. And there's no coupling constants. But otherwise, we can compute those these diagrams in the familiar way from FT1 and 2. And so that's what you're going to do in tutorial today. You're going to show that it's an impossible to set the divergences of all these currents to zero simultaneously. Any questions? Okay, so I'll see you in our other session.